Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the fallout from the third and latest North Korean nuclear test and discuss the possibility of Iranian involvement. Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological and Chemical Threats, joins us to assess how close North Korea is to deploying a nuclear-tipped missile that could be targeted at the United States. Then we will look into President Obama's initiatives announced in his State of the Union address to meet the challenges of global warming and how they contrast with the Republican response issued by Senator Marco Rubio, who in his rebuttal derisively dismissed climate change, saying, "Our government can't control the weather." Naomi Oreskes, a historian and scientist at the University of California, San Diego, and author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming, joins us to discuss what Obama can achieve in the face of Republican obstruction and denial. Then finally, we'll hear from a former priest, civil rights worker, anti-war activist, and community organizer, James Carroll, the author of Practicing Catholic and Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the ancient city that ignited the modern world. His latest column at the Boston Globe is Pope's Resignation Was His Most Important Act. And we will discuss the significance of Pope Benedict's resignation that places the Catholic hierarchy in, not above, the world of the flesh and the devil we all live in as mortals. Joining us now is Joseph Cerincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological and Chemical Threats. He was a member of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's International Security Advisory Board and prior to that directed nonproliferation and international arms programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committees on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Cerincione.
Thank you very much for having me, Ian.
And you've been quoted in, I think it's the Washington Post, saying that President Obama's strategic patience in dealing with Pyongyang has clearly failed. And a part of the reason it's failed is that we haven't been talking to them.
Well, we spent most of the last 12 years under the Bush administration and with the Obama administration not talking to North Korea. The Bush administration just didn't believe they should talk at all. The Obama administration thought that they should have strategic patience, wait for North Korea to agree to give up its nuclear program, then we would talk. That strategy clearly hasn't worked. In those 12 years, they've done 4 missile tests and 3 nuclear tests. When we do talk to them, when we talked to them during this period, they haven't done any tests at all. When we talked to them to the 90s, we were able to negotiate a deal that shut down their plutonium production facility, stopped their bomb program. We should learn something from this historical experience.
But on the other hand, last February, the administration thought they had a breakthrough when North Korea agreed to suspend its long-range missile tests in exchange for about 250,000 tons of U.S. food aid. And just a few weeks later, the North announced its plans to launch a multi-stage rocket into space, which ultimately failed. So
There's nothing easy about talking to North Korea. They're an unreliable negotiating partner. They're a despicable regime. They've had a series of succession crises. They have internal struggles. Many people think that Kim Jong-un, that's the current leader, is 20-something son of Kim Jong-il, needs to shore up his support for the military. That's why he's doing these tests. So it's very, very difficult. But you cannot then, therefore, stop the negotiations and, therefore, give up or walk away. This is like the character from Fatal Attraction. North Korea will not be ignored. They do these tests in order to increase their value, to increase the worth of their bargaining chips, and to try to get what they want out of the United States, which is security assurances, assurances that the United States will not attack it, will not try to overthrow the regime. It's not easy. There's no guarantee of success. As they say, North Korea is the land of bad choices, but clearly not talking to them has backfired.
Well, I've spoken, Joseph Cerincione, to a number of specialists on Korea and North Korea in particular, And I think in many ways, not only have we got it wrong in terms of our policies and our dealings, and but I think we've got it wrong in even framing the nature of that regime as a Stalinist communist regime. It's actually much more like Imperial Japan was under Emperor Hirohito. There is emperor worship, and it's really a kind of right-wing regime in many ways. So it seems to me that even in the basic definition of this regime, we get wrong.
Right. And there's some people call it a kleptocracy. You know, this is a clique that is obviously starving its own people in order to enrich its pockets. The elite live very well. It's the majority of the people that are suffering. And for them, these things, nuclear weapons, missiles, these are commodities. These are things they use for their security purposes, yes, their misguided idea of increasing their own prestige. But this is the great danger of the regime. It's not so much that we worry that they will use a nuclear weapon. They detonated their first device in 2006. The test they just did appears to show that they perfected a weapon. This, from all outward appearances, this appears to have been a successful weapon test. So they've achieved weaponization, taking a device and turning it into perhaps a usable weapon. What we're worried about is that they might transfer this technology, might transfer designs, know-how, perhaps even a weapon itself. So the urgency of negotiating a deal with them, of containing this program to the best we can, rises with each new test.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Joseph Cirincione, the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons and and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats. But I think in terms of what you just said, it would also be pretty clear, is it not, that because they have to have a patronage regime of the elites who live a much better life, considerably better than the average North Koreans, many of whom are starving, the money that the regime gets to maintain its patronage system is based upon a lot of criminal activity, forging $100 bills. The U.S. Mm-hmm. did close down a lot of their counterfeiting in the former colony of Macau. Not so many years ago, a North Korean ship off the coast of Australia was caught unloading tons of heroin. So it's not a stretch to imagine that since missile technology has been an enormous foreign exchange mechanism for them, that they wouldn't do a package deal where you could get a nuclear weapon along with a missile.
Right. So the whole basis of the Iranian missile program and the Pakistani missile program are based on North Korean Scud technology. They've developed the Scuds, the technology they got from the Russians, and built Nodong missiles. And they've then exported this, sold these through the AQCON network to Pakistan and directly to the Iranians. When you see a Pakistani Gowri missile or an Iranian Shahid missile, that is basically a North Korean missile with a different paint job. The Iranians and the Pakistanis have then expanded on that and taken it off into new levels. In fact, both of those countries have achieved missile technology that North Korea hasn't yet achieved, but this was the basis of it. So it's not a stretch at all to think that if they will sell missiles, they might be willing to sell nuclear material or nuclear designs, maybe even a nuclear weapon.
Well, but that leads you to speculate, if there is reciprocity and if there's an existing business relationship between the North Koreans and the Iranians and the North Koreans and the Pakistanis, and in terms of the AQCON network, my understanding is that AQCON did sell to the Iranians and the advanced miniaturized design based on a Chinese warhead that's on the tip of their nuclear arsenal. And my understanding is that, in fact, Pakistan's nuclear arsenal in many ways is a more advanced one than India's, and it's certainly the fastest growing arsenal on the planet. So isn't it reasonable to assume that there's some reciprocity and there's connections?
This is definitely a concern. It's definitely a worry, and particularly because the Pakistani weapons are uranium-based. Iran is developing a uranium enrichment process. They so far have not enriched it to weapons grade, just low grade, but it's the same basis. And yes, we do believe that they most likely got a weapon design from Pakistan. And this is why we're watching the North Korean test very carefully. From the seismic signatures, it's clear that a large explosion took place. We believe it's somewhere around a 10 kiloton range, a little smaller than the bomb that was used in Hiroshima, but about that size. What we're now looking for is to do atmospheric searching to look for trace elements that would indicate that it actually was nuclear, we think it was, and by looking at the composition of the isotopes in the air, was it plutonium, which is what the North Koreans have used, or is it uranium? If it's uranium, you're going to see alarm bells go off in capitals around the world because it indicates two things. One, that North Korea has a new source material for its weapons. Its supply of plutonium is very limited, only enough for five or six devices. Every time they test, they use a little bit of it up. But the uranium, they have an indigenous source. They could be producing this. They could produce a very large arsenal of uranium-based, and it is immediately transferable to the Iranians. We haven't seen any evidence that Iranians were involved in this test. We don't know if there were Iranian observers, but people are looking at that and watching that very carefully. It could be an Iranian shortcut to a bomb.
Well, I've spoken to a couple of our experts on nuclear proliferation and prior to the test, and they said there was a concern that they might test a fission boost weapon which indicate a certain amount of sophistication. And the unofficial spokesperson for the North Koreans, Tony Nam Kung, who's an intermediary who arranges trips over there and stuff.
Yeah, I wouldn't call him a spokesperson.
No, exactly.
He's an independent expert, but yeah.
Yeah, I was about to say, he's very knowledgeable about the regime and seems to have good connections over there.
Yeah.
And he said that prior to the test, it was going to be a thermonuclear test, which sounds a little hyperbolic. But still.
Yeah. So an atomic bomb is what we used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A hydrogen bomb is 10, 100, 200 times more powerful. It's what the U.S. has in its arsenal. We have all hydrogen bombs now. We think that's beyond the North Korean technology at this point. India has not been successful in detonating one. Pakistan hasn't been successful in detonating one. It's probably beyond the North Koreans. But you can do what you just referred to, boosting. You take a little bit of hydrogen, an isotope called tritium, and you feed it in to the atomic explosion as it's happening. And the heat of that explosion does some fusion, so it boosts the yield. So you go from, say, a 10 kiloton to maybe a 20, 30, 40, 50 kiloton bomb by this boosting technology. So far, we don't see any evidence of that, but at least in the size of the explosion that we've detected so far.
So, Joseph Sirsianni, I take it what concerns you, though, and a lot of specialists on this region and in general, people concerned about nuclear proliferation, is that if North Korea keeps testing like this, the South Koreans and the Japanese will get into the nuclear weapons business. And my understanding is that Japan has an enormous stockpile of plutonium from its civilian program. And we don't exactly know what kind of pre-planning the Japanese have done, but the assumption is, amongst a lot of experts, is that Japan could go nuclear very, very quickly.
Yes, certainly in less than a year. I mean, Japan has the know-how. They probably have a design. We don't know that for sure. They have tens of tons of plutonium, enough for a very large arsenal should they decide to do it. It's a very capable nation. It's one of the several nations around the world that could build nuclear weapons but chooses not to. That calculation could change if North Korea keeps testing. Since the first test in 2006, we've started to see some debate in Japan. It used to be off limits. You couldn't even mention this. Ministers got fired for even suggesting that Japan should consider a nuclear weapon. But now, particularly in the conservative political circles, there is open suggestion that Japan should do so. I don't think we have to worry about it now, but I do worry about it if North Korean tests continue. South Korea is the same way. Got a technological base, has shunned nuclear weapons, hasn't wanted anything to do with them. But we're now negotiating what they call a nuclear cooperation agreement between the United States and South Korea, where for the first time we may agree that South Korea could reprocess, meaning they could take some of the fuel out of their nuclear reactors, and they have a lot of them, and reprocess it to extract the plutonium. Well, that's the bomb material. If we let South Korea reprocessed the way Japan has, then South Korea, too, will have the core ingredient for a bomb. They could become a threshold state. It's a very worrying development.
So do you think that this is behind why the Chinese are concerned, although there seems to be a sort of a little bit of schizophrenia in the Chinese response, perhaps because there may be a division between the more moderate and modern thinking people in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs as opposed to the Defense Ministry in the Chinese government. But the long and the short is the new leadership seems to be taking a sterner line, and we know that if anybody could influence North Korea, because they control essentially the fuel line to this impoverished state, it is the Chinese. And surely the Chinese must see that bigger picture, that they don't want Japan to become a nuclear power.
That's exactly right. You put your finger on it, and in fact, several fingers on several points. One, 80% of North Korea's trade with the outside world, and there isn't that much of it, 80% is with China. China subsidizes North Korea economically. They subsidize oil shipments to the country. If North Korea wanted to squeeze North Korea, they certainly could, but they're afraid of a collapse. They don't want the regime to collapse. They're afraid more of millions of North Koreans streaming into Chinese provinces. The South Koreans are afraid of the same thing. So both South Korea and North Korea would like to see a soft landing of this regime. The Chinese keep talking to the North Koreans about following their economic model and changing their patterns, keep their authoritarian control, but open up, get more capitalists, etc. That's what they keep hoping for. But now they have this new worry, just as you said. What they also don't want is instability on their borders. They don't want South Korea having more excuses to arm. They don't want Japan to arm more. They don't want the proliferation of missile defenses that both South Korea and Japan could deploy to shield against North Korean missiles, or at least try to shield. And they certainly don't want those two countries developing nuclear weapons. So now they have this, exactly what you said, a schizophrenic policy. They want to tamp North Korea down. They warned them not to test. They've joined UN sanctions against testing, but they don't want to tamp them down so hard that they collapse. It's a real dilemma for the Chinese.
Well, Joseph Serruzzini, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Joseph Serruzzini, who is the president of the Plowshares Fund and author of Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological and Chemical Threats. He was a member of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's International Security Advisory Board and prior to that directed nonproliferation and international policy programs at the Center for American Progress and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also worked on the professional staffs of the House Committee on Armed Services and the Committee on Government Operations and served as staff director of the Bipartisan Military Reform Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about President Obama's initiatives to address global warming announced in the State of the Union.